This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross.
My name was on the street. And we bounce from this here, I'm gonna go down in them corners, let them people know. Word did not get back to me. My name is my name.
That's Marlo Stanfield, the most powerful drug dealer in West Baltimore, who was taken down by the police in last Sunday's episode of The Wire. This Sunday, on the series finale, we'll find out the fate of Marlo and many of the other characters on The Wire. This HBO series was described on the editorial page of the New York Times as the closest that moving pictures have come so far to the depth and nuance of the novel. My guest David Simon created the series and wrote many of the episodes. The Wire is set in Baltimore and has told the interconnecting stories of drug dealers, the kids who sell the drugs on the corners, the teachers that try to reach out to them, the cops that try to keep order on the streets, the city politicians who pressure the police to manipulate crime statistics, and the newspaper reporters who cover the city. Simon is a former reporter for the Baltimore Sun, where he covered crime. Many of the stories and characters in The Wire are based on his reporting. Simon is also the author of the nonfiction books Homicide, A Year on the Killing Streets, which was adapted into the NBC series Homicide, and The Corner, A Year in the Life of an Inner-City Neighborhood, which he adapted into an HBO miniseries. David Simon, welcome to Fresh Air, and congratulations on The Wire. What a great show. I'm so sad the series, is ending or is over. I love these characters, and I'm so sorry to lose them from my life. I wonder what it's like for you to be finished with them.
Yeah, it's strange saying goodbye. The whole universe became very real to the writers. We cared about every little corner of it, in some very absurd ways, maybe, for television.
You had to decide what the fate of each of the characters would be as the series ended. Who gets to live, who gets to die, who gets a second chance, who lives a life of misery.
Yom Kippur in the writer's room.
can you talk a little bit about what the process was like of deciding the fate of some of our favorite characters?
Well, we've been stealing big. I mean, we've been stealing from a lot of the Greek tragedies. And a lot of the characteristics of the protagonists in those plays are apparent in The Wire. And usually if someone's demonstrating that, they're going to get it.
Can you give me an example?
Hubris, a willingness to challenge the gods, a willingness to engage in an argument against one's fate. The same things that, Antigone or Oedipus struggled with, we gave the same sort of dynamic to our characters. So there wasn't a lot of escaping that. We knew where people were going for a long time based on that logic.
Who are the gods?
The gods are the post-industrial institutions of modern life.
City hall, the police department, the school system.
Whoever you serve, wherever your paycheck comes from, whatever calling you thought you had on The Wire, there's every possibility it will betray you.
I just want to talk about a couple of characters and their end in the series. We think that either Omar or Marlo is going to die. Omar is the guy who holds up the drug men and takes their money. He holds up the drug dealers. Marlo is like the drug dealer that controls most of the trade at this point, and he's kind of a sociopath. And so we think that one of them is going to gun down the other because they're out to get each other. But Omar dies in a convenience store. I think he's buying a pack of cigarettes. And one of the kids, one of the, like, the little kids in Marlo's drug gang, just kind of pops him in the back of the head when Omar's not looking, and bam, he's gone.
Yeah. There was a little bit of homage to some Western motifs, some John Ford and some Sam Peckinpah there. But the other thing is, everyone has that Achilles heel to go back and steal some more Greek. And Omar is, I love the look he gave when the bell rang in the store on the door. And he obviously dismissed the notion that Kennard was in any way a threat. It seemed like the right way. It seemed wrong to have anything happen other than what happened. And once we had arrived at that decision, and we arrived at it a long time ago, At least I did. I had a lot of arguments with writers before we got there, but it was sort of certain. I mean, the kid that was Kennard, his first scene in season three, he has a stick in his hand and he's shouting in the street, "I want to be Omar! I want to be Omar!" After a particular gun battle, and Bunk, you know, the detective sees this. So that's how far back the fates had written Omar's name down.
And it's interesting you decided to end his life not in a big dramatic gun down, high noon. It's just like pop back of the head, he's gone.
I hate television. I mean, yeah, that's the impulse would be always go bigger.
Mm-hmm.
And in fact, we gave him sort of almost the closest thing to a mythological moment.
Yes.
Omar's jump, Omar's leap. In truth, Omar is based on several guys, several stick-up guys in Baltimore who were quite legendary. And one of them, Donnie Anders, who I know and who has since righted his life and gone on to better things, he jumped from about the fifth floor of the Murphy Homes.
Trying to escape.
It was that or the bullets. And mm-hmm. he wasn't really thinking when he jumped, and screwed up his ankle a little bit, but... where there's a will, there's a way. You know, he also jumped from the Poplar Grove rail bridge another time, which is about three stories. So, it didn't strike us as being impossible, but it did strike us as being a wonderful near-mythic moment for a character that had come very close to the Greek mythic ideal.
Another murder I want to ask you about. This is the killing of Prop Joe, and Prop Joe is this really large guy who runs the co-op of drug dealers. So he runs the co-op where the guys get together and make deals to do what they can to protect themselves from the law. And so he's killed by Marlo, who's taking over the drug trade. And Marlo says to him, as he's about to kill Joe, he says something like, "Close your eyes, relax." And it's such a creepy scene. Can you talk about deciding to kill Prop Joe in that scene?
That was Ed Burns' call as to how to do it. And at the time, I remember Robert Chu thinking and talking to us and saying, that's the actor, wonderful actor from Baltimore, saying to us, I think I would keep arguing. I would keep trying to get out of this. I might make a move. I'd do something. And Ed said, well, just go on set and try the scene, see where it goes. And after the first rehearsal, he came back and told Ed, you know what? That's exactly the right way. When it comes for you, it comes for you. And it was just the right way to go. His efforts to quote-unquote civilize Marlo run counter to the basic essence of the drug culture, to the idea of unencumbered and pure ruthless capitalism. It's Aesop's fable of the turtle and the scorpion crossing the stream.
I really like the character of Prop Joe. It's like, you know, if he were in another neighborhood, he'd be a really good businessman.
I like
him too.
He's
really smart.
I like what he'll do with a toaster. He won't let a secondhand toaster go. I love all these characters. I have to say, I'm going to miss them, but they're there.
The Wire doesn't present any easy answers. There's no real solutions, but we do get a sense of how and why the system doesn't work. We don't learn how to fix it necessarily, but we do come away, I think, with a kind of understanding of the victims within that system. And you walk away with a sense of empathy for people who you might never come in contact with in the real world and might be able to, you might be able to, like, demonize them. But watching this series, you just develop empathy for so many people in so many different
I hope so.
Situations.
I do.
One of the things you wanted to do?
Yeah, I mean, I think, in fact, that's about the only victory that you could ask for from a television drama. I think you can't become too didactic and start spouting policy. Having said that, I mean, I think it's the lack of empathy that has led to this disastrous and venal drug war. If we've said anything with The Wire, we've tried to critique the drug war for being what it is. It is no longer, in places like West Baltimore, it is no longer a war against dangerous narcotics. It may have begun as such, but now it is a war against the underclass. And it's being fought by people who have against people who have not. And it is as cynical an exercise as anything I've ever seen. And I was a newspaper reporter for a lot of years. And so if there was a credible critique of anything politically, we hope that was it with the show.
As you said, you were a reporter for the Baltimore Sun for many years and covered crime for many years. And I have February 1994 article from the Baltimore Sun that you wrote that was headlined, "Drugs, a War with Feudal Tactics." And I just want to read an excerpt of that because I think what you were reporting in 1994 is evident in The Wire. You wrote, "There is simply no prison or jail space available for Baltimore's street-level drug offenders, and given the realities of Maryland's fiscal condition, little likelihood that more prison space will soon become available. Nevertheless, much of the Baltimore Police Department's effort in the war on drugs remains geared to arresting street-level violators. The rate of drug arrests in Baltimore remained nearly three times the national average for cities of comparable size in 91. The last year in which such statistics were available. Why? Many reasons, say veteran commanders and officers, not the least of which is the simple overriding fact that no arrest is easier than a street-level lockup for drugs." And then you end the article later by quoting a cop by saying, "The people in these neighborhoods know who the more serious traffickers are, and they know who the people doing the shootings are. When they see the police coming through and leave those people be while grabbing up some small-time tout or junkie, they lose any faith they ever had." So I just read that as an example of how your police reporting informed.
It's all
what's
informed
in The Wire.
That.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, you know, it's myself. It's Bill Zorzi, who covered politics for The Sun. It's Ed Burns, who policed Baltimore and then taught in the schools for 7 years. The show is rooted in people who are rooted in a real place, and that's improbable for television. And that's what I think. That's what everyone felt was so subversive. It was a very idiosyncratic message from a very real place.
This season, you have some of the detectives breaking all the rules with the larger goal of doing the right thing. What the rules have become is that funding has been cut back in order to get good statistics. That there's been a lot of drug arrests, people are being pressured to arrest small-time, small-time dealers as opposed to going after the big guys. The monies from the police department is being siphoned off into the school department because that's what the mayor needs to do politically.
Right, and he's already got the test scores from the schools up, so on the third grade level only, so he can now shift his focus.
So in order to get like money for overtime, which the police department no longer has, one of the detectives decides to kind of fake a set of serial killings among the homeless, figuring this is going to get the city's attention. They'll give us money. They'll give it to me for overtime. I'll give it to other people in the department to investigate a series of drug-related murders that will lead us to the big drug dealers. Were you ever frustrated enough in your career, or do you know cops who are ever frustrated enough in their career to ever do anything illegal like that in pursuit of a greater good?
In my career as a reporter, the only thing, I mean, the great sin would be making stuff up. And no, I didn't do that.
Which you have a reporter doing in the final season, too.
Well, yeah, I mean,
but that's not for a greater good. That's just for his own personal
gain. No, that was for self-aggrandizement. And it's always for self-aggrandizement. You know, I've never seen a fabricator in journalism that wasn't just trying to be the guy at the campfire with the best story. And we had one at The Sun. I mean, you know, he's based in a real eventuality that, you know, I sort of lived through. But so, no, I was never tempted. I mean, when I was tempted to make stuff up, I was writing for a television show, and there was no penalty. And Ed Burns, I know, was kept it clean. I think probable cause on the street level is lied about routinely in Baltimore's district court. I go up there, and I listen to how police explain the various manner in which they've undertaken street arrests, and, you know, some of it's quite laughable. And the judges will tell you that when they get off the bench. You know, if you have a drink with a judge in Baltimore District Court, they'll roll their eyes at what's become a probable cause because of the drug war. Has anyone tried to manufacture a serial killer? No, that really is the drama of television. At the same time, the way in which we had him do it is actually credible. Antemortem strangulation is something that actually can confound even a good pathologist.
This is after a body's dead, when you strangle a corpse and make it look like the cause of
freshly,
murder was strangled.
A relatively fresh corpse. And if the body's in a dependent position, meaning, or if the head is in a dependent position, meaning the blood, the lividity is going to the head.
Mm-hmm.
I found that out because I was in the morgue one day when I was working on the book Homicide, and I saw a county detective getting in an argument with a cutter over that precise thing. And later on, I took the cutter to lunch, and he explained, look, there's no way you can tell the difference under these circumstances. This is one that anyone could miss. So, we cheated it, but we cheated it credibly in our heads.
Let me ask you about another story that you wrote that one of the characters in The Wire is kind of based on. And the story was headlined, "The Metal Men, with quick drug money as their goal, they're stealing and selling every bit of aluminum, iron, brass, and copper they can cart out of city buildings." This is Dateline September 3rd, 1995. And the story was about mostly junkies who were scavenging the city, taking like metal and aluminum off of buildings to sell to companies for scrap. And they were not only doing this out of on abandoned buildings, but they were sometimes taking apart usable, currently in use buildings and destroying them. And here's like one quote from a character named Gary, one of the metal men. And you write, "Gary is the rare metal man. He won't lie about any of it. Fact is, when he's sated with chemicals and the nausea is gone and he can think about things for a few minutes, he's genuinely ashamed. Quote, we tore up the boiler in this school for $70 in copper, he says. For $70, we did like $10,000 in damage." Can you talk a little bit about how you got onto the story and what?
Sure.
The repercussions of it, you know, the after effects of it were?
Well, actually, that was the story that ended my career in journalism. You happened to have come across it. Those are the repercussions for me, anyway. There were no repercussions in the outside world, I don't think. I think business went on as usual. But the Gary that you quote is Gary McCullough. And I, 3 years later, I published a book about him called The Corner. And he's no longer with us, but the main characters he was one of the guys, but I actually followed other people to keep it separate from the book for the main narrative of that story. That story got spiked by the editor of the Baltimore Sun without explanation, and I think it was towards the end when I had started to critique the paper from within and started to make arguments for the journalism that I valued. I think he was quite disappointed with me. So he actually, the story was as it ran, ultimately he spiked it. And when I went in to talk with him, it became a wide-ranging conversation about me getting on the team and not criticizing and a variety of things that were as institutional as anything you'd ever see in The Wire. And then one of his other editors came in and said to him, "I don't know why you spiked that story that, you brought me to here to do that kind of work, and why is that sitting in the kill basket?" So it ran in the magazine. He wouldn't run it in the paper. He put it in the Sunday magazine, which was on its last legs then. They were about to kill it. But I had made up my mind as a result of sort of that conversation that it was time for me to leave journalism. Because to me, that story was what I valued. It was a nuanced narrative. It held what was happening to account. It talked about the damage done, but it did so in human terms.
So this is an example of why you're so cynical about some editors in The Wire, because there's a couple of editors in The Wire
I'm cynical about everybody in management.
Yeah.
I don't think they differ from, Valchek, one of the police commanders. He destroys a man because they're fighting over the place of a stained glass window in a Catholic church. I think the archetype of all our bosses comes from Paths of Glory. I don't know if you know the Kubrick film Paths of Glory, mm-hmm. but that is to me one of the fundamental political films of the 20th century. And you look at George MacReady and Adolph Manjou in that movie, and those are the Wire bosses throughout seasons 1 through 5. So I don't think we're any more cynical about the editors than we are about politicians or police commanders. I think some newspapermen got a little bit upset about it, but journalism's a little bit self-absorbed and onanistic, and it was all fun and games when we were making fun of politicians and police commanders and school superintendents. But God forbid you mock the foibles of an editor in chief somewhere, and now you got trouble.
Many of the characters and plot lines are based on stories he covered when he was a crime reporter for the Baltimore Sun. Before the break, we were talking about Gary McCullough, a junkie and metal scavenger who inspired the character of Bubbles on The Wire. David Simon and his co-executive producer Ed Burns, a former Baltimore police detective, shadowed Gary for a year while they were working on their book, The Corner. Simon says Gary had no problem with them following him while he was participating in illegal activities.
Gary was sort of an open soul. He was Gary was interested in everything. Gary would get high and go to his basement and read. I'll never forget, Gary read Karen Armstrong's History of God.
Really?
The year that we were following him. When Gary one time,
that's
he wanted
pretty,
to...
That's a lot of scholarship. That's not...
It was. And Gary was, he was just open to the world. And the idea that, I should tell a story here, which is that Ed and I would go up to the Corners late in 92, and say, we're going to do a book here, we're this. I used to be, I'm the guy who wrote Homicide. Ed was a police detective, yes. I know you remember him. I know he once served a warrant on you. Stop, eyeing him. He is now retired. We're going to do a book. Please trust us. And everyone would go, cops. nobody believed us. And then we went into Gary's mother's house up on Vine Street and met Gary in the living room. And we gave him the same spiel, and he looked at us and went, okay, great. This is going to be an amazing book, he was a little bit credulous, which was part of his problem in the drug culture. He suffered from being a little bit credulous. In our case, we weren't lying, but he was really open to the world, and we followed Gary everywhere. And, part of that is he's a little bit preoccupied trying to get through the day, but part of it was just his nature.
So when you were watching Gary steal metal and you knew it was going to be bad for the city and bad for some individuals whose homes or offices he was scavenging from, did it present any moral dilemmas to you as the witness to it?
I confess it didn't. Let me take it a step further. When Ed Burns and I were in that neighborhood in 1993, there was a guy killed. Murdered, stabbed to death on the street, and we knew who did it. We weren't eyewitnesses, but we had all the information as to who did it, why they did it, how it happened, who said what to whom just before the knife went in. I mean, we had the whole thing. Ed had been a former homicide detective, and I had many friends in the homicide unit from having done the previous book on the homicide unit, and we did not pick up the phone and call. When we came into that neighborhood, we told everybody that we were there as journalists, not as police, not as any other arm of the government, that we were there to record life in that neighborhood of Franklin Square and around those drug corners for 1 year. When I gave my word to anybody, in any regard, it's my word. And I have to abide by the terms of the situation if I've given my word. And so, there was no real practical way that I could start mitigating that because certain things had happened. You can't play that way. I was there under certain terms, mm-hmm. and I wanted to be able to look everybody in the eye and say, when I told you all this stuff back in 92 about how we would behave, we kept our word.
There's a lot of fantastic African-American actors on The Wire, most of whom I'd never seen before in other roles. How did you get the word out when you were casting?
That's Alexa Fogle, and it's Pat Moran in Baltimore. Mm-hmm. There is a wonderfully deep reservoir of African American talent. There really is, and they're not working. There's just not enough work. Nobody's writing the parts. What they are writing is marginal at best, and so. There's just a natural hunger there. And, I mean, our second and third choices for some of these roles were great reads. Sometimes we came back and used them for something else later in the run. You know, I always bristle when I hear people on shows that are supposedly race neutral in their casting. And you know, they come out lily white and somebody asks them about it and they say, well, you know, there's just a, not that level of talent, you know, among black actors. I hear that. I get furious.
Do you have a favorite casting story?
That's an interesting. Oh, I'll give you a casting story. So we're going to read Wendell Pierce for Bunk.
This is one of the detectives.
Yes, absolutely, and a true character. And by the way, the real Bunk is in our heads because he was named Oscar Aguirre, and he was quite a character. And what he, you know, he's a wonderful guy, retired now from the police department. He just retired. And so Ed and I have this guy in our heads, and you know, Wendell comes in to read in New York, and he just nails it. He is Bunk. You know, and like we're so solid that this is, you know, if this guy's available, the show begins with us casting him. And then after he apologizes, he was a little late for the and a little flustered. He didn't think he did well, and he started telling this long story about getting in an argument with a New York cab driver about who wouldn't pick him up because he was black, and you know he was trying to get here and this and that, and this was the night before, and you know, and he got locked up. Like, you know, he got in an argument and the police locked him up. And it was in the telling of that story that, I mean, I was holding my side. He told it, you know, in classic Bunk fashion. It came out as if Oscar Aguirre had been telling it in the Baltimore Homicide Unit. And so the telling of the story was like, you know, no, we don't need to call you back. We're going to call you back when we have a McNulty and you'll read with him, but you're Bunk. And I'll never forget the story because it was he was infuriated and apologetic at the same time and funny. And that's, you know, to do all three things in a long anecdote in front of a couple of producers and a director and a casting agent, I thought it was a tour de force.
Were you confident he'd be able to do that when somebody else was writing the lines?
I'm confident he could, you know, read the phone book and I could, you know, I could probably pull in a couple hundred thousand viewers with it. I mean, he's a special guy.
Did the real detective who you based the character on smoke a cigar like Bunk?
He did all the time. In fact, he showed up at the first scene that we were filming with Bunk, which was the crime scene of the killing of William Gant, which ends the pilot episode. And here comes this, you know, I think it was a Buick to the curb, and out gets Oscar Aguirre, you know. Yeah, where's the Bunk? Where's Bunk? You know, I'm like, you're the Bunk. He goes, nah, I mean the other Bunk. Where's your Bunk? You know, and he goes, grabs his hands, it like looks him up and down, and goes, yeah, all right. You know, like stands around for a few minutes and then goes, all right, I got to go. He puts the cigar back in his mouth and drives away. It was like, okay, you know, you've been blessed. It was just beautiful.
Did you shoot a lot? I mean, I know you shot a lot on the streets of Baltimore. I'm not sure whether, were the streets that were largely made up of abandoned houses, real streets with abandoned houses?
Listen, I don't want to take away from our art direction because choosing the locations and finding the locations and then carefully dressing them to exactly what we need is really, you know, I mean, there was a lot of hard work done. So I don't want to suggest we just ran out into Baltimore and turned the cameras on. But having said that, Baltimore is an amazing place to film. I think it falls down better than any city short of New Orleans. It's beautiful in its tragedy, at least the inner city part of it. And it's beautiful in other ways in places that, you know, listen, I live in Baltimore. It's not all impoverished ghetto. But having said that, there's something about those row houses, those federal style row houses and the boards and the windows and the formstone and the red brick, you know, to me, it's just beautiful. And the more we could shoot out on the street, the better.
Did you shoot in places that you'd never go to on your own without cameras and a crew because they were too dangerous?
I was a police reporter for a lot of years, and I felt that my city was not Beirut. It was not Fallujah. It was a place that I ought to be able to go with a notepad and talk to somebody if they needed to be interviewed. And so there was no place that I felt like I wouldn't go. I admit to being squeamish when I would have to get in the lifts and, you know, in the elevators at the
at the project,
at the Murphy Homes, at the Lexington Terrace, at the high rises, mm-hmm. which are no longer there. you know, just that sense of going up, and, you know, you got to talk to somebody in Unit 10B, you know, in the 770 building, and, you know, you're going up, and or the lift is broken, you got to climb the stairs, and you're walking past drug deals. That was kind of creepy, because, like, you know, I'm going up, and I got to come back down. But I always felt like you get about 5 minutes on the street, if you know where you're going, when everyone's trying to figure out whether you're worth robbing or not. You know, you get that 5 minute, like, is that a social worker or is it a cop, or I can't, you know, what's that notepad about? And in that delay, I felt like I could go anywhere. And I have to say, you know, I never got robbed in years of being a police reporter and going into every neighborhood in the city. The one time I got robbed, I was with Gary McCullough doing the corner book, and Ed and I were dressed.
Is the metal man, Gary?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. He was going to cop, or actually we were not going to cop. We were just walking on Fulton Avenue, and Ed Burns and myself and Gary, and they thought we looked like two white guys, you know, with Gary who were looking a cop. So they held us up for, you know, the $2.50 I had in my pocket, and it was all very officious and, you know, inform, you know, sort of like pro forma. And then they said, "Is this all you got?" And we were like, "Yeah." And they were like, "Okay, done." That's it. That's the sole extent of my violent encounters in Baltimore, Maryland.
Listen, I don't want to get into the whole controversy about you versus the editors who you've represented in a fictional way in the series.
I don't blame you.
I just want to ask you one question about that. One of them is presumed to be Bill Marimo, who had been with the Philadelphia Inquirer and then was at the Baltimore Sun. When you were there, is back at the Philadelphia Inquirer, now was at NPR in between. And you not only appear to have based one of the editors on him, or so everybody thinks, but
everyone thinks.
Yeah, one of the people in the police force who was kind of brought in as a kind of disciplinarian, is that fair to say, was named Marimo. And I wonder if you have any regrets about that because of it being a real person. Do you know what I mean? And not.
Well, he was named Charlie Marimo, and we used the first name.
Right.
And I did think I was being playful in my teasing at that point. And I was very, in my mind, what I was doing was I was burying the name on the police side of things. And since, you know, Bill Marimo has never been a police officer and never will be, I thought I was having my play in a way that was safe for him. I would not have had anyone named Marimo anywhere near the media story or even the political story. I thought that might intersect with the newspaper story. I placed the name in a locale where I thought there was plausible deniability, and then I changed the name to make it Charles. And my past is my past, and you know, I think I'm entitled to tell stories with it the same way that anybody working in fiction tells stories, using their past experiences and conversations and relationships. And, you know, that's what, you know, I'm writing like anyone else is writing. And ultimately, you know, that has to stand. You know, if that is saying something meaningful about the matter at hand, which is in this case journalism, then, you know, I don't think I'm going to hesitate to write it. And ultimately, the bottom line is that, you know, Mr. Carroll and Mr. Marimo, they value a different kind of journalism than I do. You know, what I was doing and what mattered to me at a newspaper, they did not have much regard for. And what they were doing at the Baltimore Sun, I had low regard for. So that's just going to be a divorce.
One of the major plots that a couple of the seasons of The Wire turn on is that the drug dealers, hitmen, are killing people and hiding their bodies in vacant houses and then nailing those bodies shut. And so, like, 22 murders are hidden behind 22 vacant houses. How did you come up with that plot idea?
No, that was Ed Burns. Ed loved the idea of using the vacants because there were, I think, at the time there were like 20,000 vacants in Baltimore, boarded up like that.
Wow.
And I mean, as soon as he said it, it was totally credible. I mean, in this sense, I had been with the homicide unit in 88, and I knew that when you were called to a vacant for an unattended death there, you just prayed it wasn't a murder because, you know, it's the worst place. You know, it wasn't on the street. There's going to be no witnesses. You know, the crime scene's going to be screwed. It was the worst thing you could have happen to you as a Baltimore detective, to have one in the row houses. And there were murders in the row houses, people who were lured in there and shot and killed. And, you know, I'm not suggesting anybody ever did 22. You know, you could lay 22 names on any given person or anything like that, but there were murders in those vacants. And there were also a lot of straight overdose deaths and natural cause, you know, squatters who died in there. It was a cemetery in plain sight. And sometimes the bodies would be in there for a long time because if there were vacants on either side, you know, the body would decomp without anybody really thinking much of it. You know, people might walk past the row house and think, wow, you know, there's a dead animal in there. But, you know, when Ed said it, it was like, oh, my God, that's gothic, you know. What's wrong with you, Ed?
It's beautiful. Ed Burns, who co-wrote with you a lot of the episodes of The Wire and worked with you on it from the very beginning to the very end, had been a detective in the Baltimore Police Force, and you knew him as a reporter when you were covering the crime beat. Can you talk about how you met and what you, like, how you worked together?
Well, I guess we didn't work together when he was my source or one of my sources. He was doing his job and I was pulling on his coat about stuff. And I guess I can, you know, I've obviously revealed him as a source, but hey, I'm not working as a reporter and he's not working as a cop. It feels completely benign to do it. But when I first met him, it was over the Melvin Williams articles. I'd been assigned by my editor to do a series of articles, or at least a long article at that point, on Melvin Williams and his career, because he'd just been busted by Ed and Harry Edgerton in that wiretap case.
When he was busted as a drug lord.
Yes, in 1984. And so March 85, April of 85, somewhere around there, I went up to the DEA offices where Ed was still doing a lot of work, sort of cleaning that case up. And I met him and Harry and did a very sort of cursory kind of like we're in the office interview. You know, it was all very cautious. And I asked if I could meet Ed sort of later. One of my things as a reporter was if I can get a guy, you know, having a beer or, you know, eating a meal or just, you know, sitting around, I'll get better stuff than if they're sitting in the DEA offices, you know, with me having my notepad out. And so Ed said, yeah. He said, but, you know, I don't really want to meet you in a bar. You know, Ed's not that kind of guy. Or he's not that kind of guy anymore, I guess. But I've heard stories when he was back in the Western. But, you know, when I knew him, he was, you know, happy homebody. Anyway, he said, why don't you meet me at the Towson Library Branch? And I thought, wow, this is furtive, you know. he really doesn't want to be seen. And when I got up there, he was checking out a bunch of books. And it was, I remember some of the titles. It was The Magus by Foles. And it was a collection of essays by Hannah Arendt. And it was Veil by Woodward, which was out at the time. And I looked out at the books and I remember saying to him, you're not really a Baltimore cop, are you? You know, what do you do for a living? Because you know, it was just a wide range of interests. And I got to know him. And, you know, not only was he more forthcoming outside of the place, but he had a lot of very strong opinions about what was going wrong with the drug war, what was going wrong with policing. You know, everyone jokes about my assertive and violent rage over all the things that happened in journalism and the guys who were my supervisors. You ought to hear Ed talk about the police department. I mean, all that stuff's in The Wire as well. They just don't, you know, they don't write about themselves. So I guess it's just, you know, it's a different dynamic. But hearing his dissertations on what had gone wrong with the drug war, I was fascinated. And, you know, that was the beginning of a relationship now at this point. I mean, not including the source stuff, but I started to, when he left the police department, I hired him to do The Corner with me. And we co-wrote that together and co-reported that together. And so this relationship now goes back, wow, 16 years.
Yeah, that's great.
Professional relationship.
Well, David Simon, our time is up. I just want to thank you so much for The Wire.
I want to thank you
for this conversation. Thank you so much.
I want to thank you. I've been a fan for a long time. I really have been.
David Simon created the HBO series The Wire. The Wire concludes this Sunday. Jazz critic Kevin Whitehead says there are a lot of soprano saxophone players in jazz. Many of them have a whiny tone, like the horn has a bad cold. And then there's Jane Ira Bloom.
Jane Ira Bloom's soprano sax, shadowed by Dawn Clements' piano. For over 20 years, Bloom has had one of the most distinctive and noble sounds in jazz, instantly recognizable once you know it. Her tone is uncluttered and pure with very little vibrato. Some would say no vibrato, but most jazz musicians have at least a little. Those tiny fluctuations in pitch help push a note forward in time. Bloom likes to move when she plays, and occasionally drapes her sound in gauzy electronics. She may combine those tendencies using motion sensors to trigger the gizmos when she swings the bell of her horn around. One reason it works? Her lines have strong momentum to begin with. That's Mental Weather from Jane Ira Bloom's new album of the same name. To these ears, it's one of her very best, owing to her invention and good taste as an improviser and an alert quartet. Beside or behind Dawn Clement on piano, drummer Matt Wilson and bassist Mark Elias really hear how to push and pull together. Jane Ira Bloom's writing is also strong on Mental Weather. The tune, A More Interesting Question, deliberately evokes the stately motion and dramatic sweep of classic Broadway ballads. It starts very like Gershwin's I Love You Porgy and borrows a lick from Bernstein's Some Other Time, but she places those found objects on her own canvas. Cribbing bits of old tunes for that ballad isn't Jane Ira Bloom's only exercise in modular recombination. The Mental Weather CD includes two versions of the program, the full one in 9 separate tracks, and a shorter, continuous edit tucked away on disc as an MP3 file. That version sequenced like a live set, with the tunes in a different order, and in some cases lightly trimmed to accommodate new transitions. But for all that cutting and pasting, and Bloom's use of electronics, her music always feels organic, full of life and with plenty of heart. ¶¶
Kevin Whitehead teaches English and American Studies at the University of Kansas, and he's a jazz columnist for eMusic.com. He reviewed Mental Weather, the new recording by Jane Ira Bloom on the Outline label. You can download podcasts of our show on our website, freshair.npr.org.